From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
What's next in Afghanistan? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. America's 33,000 troop surge in Afghanistan has ended a week before the president's deadline this coming Sunday. What did hundreds of lives and tens of billions of dollars accomplish over the past 2 years? Soldiers, diplomats, and other observers don't agree. It's unclear if it's safe for remaining coalition troops to train Afghan security forces, or if the Taliban are just waiting for final U.S. withdrawal in 2014. Does America have the political will to make good on its promise to maintain Afghanistan's integrity long after that? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the continuing bias against women in science. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Obama told the UN General Assembly today that the war in Afghanistan will end on schedule in 2014, but that's all he said. What did he leave out? Today we'll talk about a war that could get a lot more complicated before it is finally over. On Reporter's Notebook, even women science professors view female students as less capable than men with the same credentials. We'll hear about that. First, this news update. In that General Assembly address today, President Obama asked world leaders to condemn the deadly attacks against U.S. diplomats and embassies in Egypt and Libya. He said he does not believe violence or hate speech represents the views of most Muslims any more than the video Innocence of Muslims represents those of Americans.
I do believe that it is the obligation of all leaders in all countries to speak out forcefully against violence and extremism. It is time to marginalize those who, even when not directly resorting to violence, use hatred of America or the West or Israel as the central organizing principle of politics.
Scott Wilson covers the White House for the Washington Post. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
You've written today that this address defended the U.S. role in the Middle East and North Africa to an extent that the president hasn't done before. What did he say that was unusual?
You'll recall that we have an election about 5 weeks away, and President Obama has been accused by Mitt Romney of apologizing too often for America and not doing enough to promote its principles. Basically, the speech today was a real refutation of that criticism. I don't know if it was meant for Mr. Romney. It did seem more meant for world leaders, but he made no apologies at all for U.S. role in trying to promote democracy and transitions in Libya and in Egypt and in Yemen. And he made clear that the United States wasn't going to go away and it wasn't going to compromise on principles that he said included free speech that made criticism of him fair game at home.
So 5 weeks before the election, you think a speech to the U.N. General Assembly does have significance for the campaign?
I do. I mean, maybe I'm listening too closely or listening for something that's not there, but, you know, clearly this was I almost think you could call it a defiant speech in a way. He did no bilateral meetings with other world leaders while he was here, so this was President Obama's statement to the world today. And it very much was, the United States is present, it believes in this set of principles, it believes others should too, and it's not going to go away in promoting them.
Later on, both Romney and the president spoke at Bill Clinton's I forget what he calls it now, but it's the his international global initiative. Thank you very much. They had interesting things to say. First, with regard to Romney, he didn't take the president up on the failure to have bilateral meetings. He just made a joke about how important it is to have kind words from Bill Clinton, which he did when Bill Clinton introduced him.
That's right. I mean, it was a pretty politics-free event. The two appeared a couple hours apart. Mitt Romney talked mostly about how foreign aid should be used to promote free economies and prosperity abroad. President Obama didn't mention the campaign at all. really couldn't even find undertones in it, gave a speech strictly about the need to better combat human trafficking around the world, which he called modern slavery.
And said that was even true here in the United States. Back to his speech to the United Nations, he did speak out very strongly about preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Did he use any stronger language than he has in the past for that? Mitt Romney, of course, has criticized him for not doing enough.
Right. He did not, actually. And one thing to always listen to in Iran's statements is for the word weapon. He said we will do whatever it takes to prevent Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. Israel would like Mr. Obama to be a bit more liberal on that and say nuclear capacity or capability. But he did not move that so-called red line at all today and continued to say that Iran would not be allowed to gain a nuclear weapon. And the United States would do whatever it took to prevent that.
You're a White House correspondent, but I'm interested in your assessment of how the speech went over today with the General Assembly. Did he get a lot of applause? Was he well-received, particularly given all the criticism that's been going on, particularly in the Muslim world?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It's a pretty staid audience, as is custom. There were about four moments of applause. I thought they came at interesting times, though. One was when he said that, as President Commander in Chief, he was called horrible things every day and would defend people's rights to continue to say them. That drew applause immediately from the audience, which I found very interesting and very perceptive of him. What he was getting to. So I think in general his reception was warm. And in his call on all world leaders to condemn the extremism and violence that's taking place over this video, I think met with the right kind of welcome.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Scott Wilson. Again, covering the White House for The Washington Post. I went up to New York to watch the speeches at the UN and at the Global Initiative of Bill Clinton as well. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much, Warren.
In a moment, what's next in Afghanistan? On To The Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Onley back with To The Point. When President Obama's 33,000 troop surge in Afghanistan ended a week early, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta made the announcement during a trip to New Zealand. In today's speech to the United Nations, the president mentioned Afghanistan only once.
The war in Iraq is over. American troops have come home. We've begun a transition in Afghanistan, and America and our allies will end our war on schedule in 2014.
Again, that was it. 68,000 American soldiers, of course, are scheduled to stay in Afghanistan until 2014. What's likely to happen between now and then? Ron Nordland is the New York Times correspondent in Kabul. And, Rod, the United States recently has canceled the joint training exercises between American soldiers and Afghan soldiers and police. To what extent does that suggest a setback and the possibility that the surge maybe didn't accomplish as much as the president hoped it would?
Well, those kind of joint operations that they've canceled, and they weren't just exercises like training exercises, but actual operations at anything below the battalion level. That was the core of the administration's strategy for both, for both prosecuting the war and also for bringing Afghan forces up to a level in which they could actually take it over themselves.
So this is pretty important then, and your point that it's operations, not just training exercises, is significant. Does this leave the Afghans on their own right now?
No, because I think basically in most cases, Afghans do not do very much on their own anyway. So what it means is they just stay on their bases. They're not going to go out without Americans in most cases. There's a few specialized units like commandos who are very well trained that may possibly do some of their own operations. But, you know, I've been asking the Afghan military for a year to take me along on one of these mythical independent operations that they supposedly are conducting all the time now. And so far, I don't know any journalist that they've actually taken along on such an operation.
Well, now, what we're talking about here, the reason for the cancellation of the operations is what's called green-on-blue violence. So tell us what that is and how it happens.
Well, it's just a term. It's actually a NATO term originally, and it's a term That means an ally shooting the host or the host country force shooting its ally. And there have been, so far this year, 50-some cases of that, which is about twice the rate that we saw the previous year. Just why it's increasing, it is not very clear, but what we do know is that at least a fourth of those cases were the result of Taliban infiltration. Another fourth were probably personal disputes or cultural differences that turned into arguments and went and got bloody. And then another half of them, the perpetrators are dead, so there's no way to really be sure what happened. But I think it's safe to assume that a lot of them were Taliban infiltrators, too.
Were they also, or again, it's difficult to know, of course, just ordinary Afghans who got into the military and for some reason took offense? Or you said a quarter of them were personal, but might that extend to some of the other half that are unaccounted for as well?
It might, it might. But the half, the reason they're unaccounted for is because they're dead. And that suggests that in most of those cases, they deliberately, carried out an attack that they knew would result in their basically their suicide, and that's more the hallmark of something that Taliban infiltrators would do rather than something that a guy who suddenly gets angry or just can't take, being ribbed or whatever reason. That's he doesn't necessarily want to kill himself, and that's the profile in most of those other 50% cases. Either way, neither scenario bodes very well for cooperation between the two forces.
Are there plans to better screen the trainees and renew the joint operations, or are they indefinitely suspended?
They haven't really said. They said they're suspended, so that that's not canceled. I'd be very surprised if we see them come back on stream anytime soon. They are going back through the recruits and vetting them much more carefully than they have before. They're getting a lot more investigation of their backgrounds and trying to make sure that they have the proper documentation and so on. And that's already resulted in, I think, something like 600 recruits or recent recruits being dismissed from the military. And although the military is the Afghan military is 190,000 men, 195,000, 600 may not sound like much, but the fact is that because of the very high attrition rate in the Afghan National Army, they need a constant supply of fresh recruits just to keep up the training tempo.
Rod Nordland, again, reporting from Kabul, where he is correspondent for The New York Times. Dr. Joseph Collins is professor of national security strategy at the National War College. He's a retired Army colonel, served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Stability Operations from 2001 until 2004. He's made recent visits to Afghanistan. And Colonel, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Warren.
You have indicated you think that the surge itself did make important gains. So what we're hearing from Rod Nordland and what we've heard reported from others as well about the green-on-blue violence suggests that things aren't going as well as they might.
The green-on-blue violence has been a setback, and it's increased from almost nothing before 2009 to 20 in 2010, 35 in 11 and nearly 30 already this year, and those statistics are not they're about a month behind the calendar. So that's been it has been a big problem, but it's also part and parcel of the success of the surge. The surge was designed to create the space for the rapid expansion of the Afghan National Army and police, which it did. These are coming in the wake of increased interactions by many, many thousands per day between Afghan and U.S. military. I don't want to sugarcoat it. It's not a good sign. But I also think we ought not to believe that it's going to be a permanent sign. I think both sides are working real hard to erase the cause of this and get this down to a manageable level.
The surge cost many billions of dollars over 2 years' time. There were many casualties as a result. What do you think it accomplished?
I think it created the space to rapidly expand the Afghan National Security Forces, and it also dealt the Taliban and their friends a tremendous blow. The Taliban has changed their method of operation during the surge. Before the surge, they were operating in unit level and moving into the second and third phase of guerrilla warfare. Now they're back down to doing what are essentially terrorist-style attacks and demonstration attacks. They're an adaptive enemy. I don't want to take anything away from them, but they're still out there fighting. But they've been knocked back a peg by the surge forces.
So let me go back to Rod Nordland again in Kabul for the New York Times. Do you agree that the surge did, in fact...
Yeah, no. No, I completely agree. It certainly did create that space, and it did allow them to ramp up the size of the Afghan forces, and it did force the Taliban to adjust their tactics from actually confronting troops on the ground to much more of a kind of bomb and suicide bomb-centric strategy. But surge is over now, and it remains to be seen, you know, if especially Afghan forces can hold on to those gains that have been made when they're in a lot of these the former surge areas, you know, they're going to be in a lot of those areas largely by themselves now. And we'll see if the Taliban don't just waltz right back in.
Colonel Collins, what's your response to that? And also the term that Rod Nordland used about Afghan troops conducting operations on their own. He says that's mythical.
First, I'm hoping that's one of the things that's going to make up from the surge troops is that in 2008, the Afghan National Security Forces were at 140,000. Now they're at 350,000. Sooner or later, those forces are going to be out there. And I think their operations in the field are certainly going to be curtailed by the suspension of U.S. and other coalition advisors down to the battalion level. But let's not forget, you also have U.S. advisors in logistical elements, in Corps headquarters and brigade headquarters, and those advisory efforts will continue to go on. I don't think the independent Afghan operations are mythical. I do think that the Afghans still need, even the best of units, need American help around the edges, and all of them look to us for things like air support.
Let me introduce Rajiv Chandrasekharan. He's a senior correspondent for The Washington Post, author most recently of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be on with you, Warren.
You've been critical of the surge. You've said it was wasteful in many ways. A pickup from the conversation we've had with Colonel Collins and Rod Nordland, and tell us in what ways it seems wasteful, and is this green-on-blue violence a consequence of that?
Well, I think in part, a tangential connection, Warren. But look, I've been critical of the surge in a couple of different ways. The first being strategically, it relied on other things having to happen to have a key strategic effect. Chief among them that the government of President Hamid Karzai would be an effective partner with U.S. forces, and I think we have not seen that occur, that the Pakistani government would take steps to meaningfully crack down on Taliban sanctuaries on its own soil. That has not really occurred. Yes, the addition of U.S. forces, I agree with Rod and Colonel Collins, that resulted in security improvements, particularly in the south. The Taliban have been beaten back in areas. The key question here is, will those gains be sustained? Will the Afghan army be able to really take the baton from U.S. forces? And I think it's an open question, but I think there's a lot of room for real doubt. Take, for instance, Helmand Province in the southwestern part of Afghanistan, which was a real focus of U.S. surge operations. For the past couple of years, U.S. military and diplomatic officials have taken a lot of comfort in the fact that they had a governor of that province that was very supportive of coalition military actions, sought to help build local governments that would work in conjunction with both U.S., British, and Afghan security forces, essentially a partner in those counterinsurgency efforts, the likes of which we were not seeing at the national level. Well, what happened a week ago? President Karzai has fired that provincial governor. Just at the very moment that we have dropped down to 6,000 troops in that province, 6,000 U.S. troops, raises a real big question about whether the Afghan government is going to carry forward a lot of what has been expended with huge amounts of blood and treasure over there. And just one additional point to make on this green-on-blue phenomenon. I'm not so sure that we're going to get to a point where these sorts of attacks can be meaningfully reduced. I fear that this is simply a new reality, a grim new reality that we're going to have to deal with in Afghanistan.
Let me interrupt you for a moment because I want to get back to Rod Nordland, who's going to have to leave us at the halfway point of our program in Kabul with the New York Times. Do you agree that the Karzai government has not been an effective partner? What about the firing of the supportive governor in Helmand province?
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of problems with Karzai. The list is endless. I mean, there was the time that he flipped out and claimed he was going to join the Taliban. Firing Governor Mongal in Helmand is certainly one of those. He's been trying to do it for years. The Brits and the Americans resisted it, and now in the name of, you know, at least paying some sort of homage to the Afghan government's sovereignty, they have stood aside on this one. They're standing aside, too, on issues like corruption, especially the Americans are no longer pushing corruption in any kind of meaningful way, even though, you know, the mantra just a year or two ago was that, you know, unless they did something about good governance, there wasn't going to be an Afghan government to support in the long term. So yeah, I think all those things look very bad. And even with the surge forces in the south, they still were never able to make the road between the two major cities in the south, Lashkargah and Kandahar, a safe road for people to travel on. And that's just going to get worse. The districts around Kandahar City, which are the original home of the Taliban, they're still very dangerous, most of them, and still going to require large numbers of troops, which are not going to be there except in terms of Afghan troops. So there are all sorts of problems, and things don't look very encouraging at all.
Well, Rod Nordland in Kabul for the New York Times, thanks very much for being on our program today. We really appreciate it. We're going to take a very brief break. Later on, Reporter's Notebook, the ongoing bias against women in science. We'll be back in a minute. Continue this conversation with our current guests and also Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist. We'll talk about that country as well on To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To The Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman Ali back with To The Point, talking about progress in Afghanistan in the aftermath of the surge, which ended last week, a week earlier than the president had said it would. That, of course, amounting to 33,000 American troops sent for the past 2 years to bolster the 68,000 that are still in that country and will be until 2014. We just heard from Rod Nordland, and from Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who's still with us, author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, that two of the things that were thought to be crucial to the strategy haven't turned out to be the case. One, that the Karzai government has not been an effective partner. Secondly, that the green and blue violence has now appeared. I want to go back to Colonel Joseph Collins at the National War College, former retired colonel, served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Stability Operations. Colonel, how do you respond to what we heard from the others?
There's no doubt that as we transition from a coalition security lead to an Afghan security lead, that we're going to have areas where we fall back in. The two areas we've talked about the most here, Helmand and Kandahar, are probably the two toughest nuts in the sack. And these These are areas where the Taliban always was strong and will come back strong. The government there is going to have to work a lot harder than it has been to maintain the progress that's been made in those areas. I think, though, when we sort of look for the Afghans and try to measure them in accordance with the standards of operations that the coalition, and especially the United States, has set, I think that's a big mistake. I think what we're going to find that in a lot of these areas, there's going to be a new way of warfare. It may include side deals, front deals, fighting, and areas where the Afghan forces will make a lot of progress through what we would call political negotiations with the local Taliban or the local resistance movements of whatever particular stripe that they are. There's no doubt about it. There's no one in the Afghan National Army that's going to come up to the standards of the 82nd Airborne Division and the 101st and the Green Berets. But I think you're going to find that this force is an Afghan force. They're going to operate in an Afghan style, and they have tremendous materiel superiorities over the local Taliban troops, and there's no reason why they can't hold their own. But once again, they're not going to do it the way we did it or the way the British or the French did either.
Let me go back to Rajiv Chandrasekaran. What about your concern that the strategy was based in part on Pakistan's cracking down on the people who cross the border into Afghanistan? How much of a problem has that been?
Well, it is a continuing and in fact, growing problem, Warren. The South, which we've talked about, remains a tough nut because certainly the Taliban were very strong there. In eastern Afghanistan, in the areas around Kabul, the capital, and key provinces between Kabul and the Pakistani border, the Taliban are surprisingly strong and resurgent, and that's because it's a Taliban faction operating there called the Haqqani Network that has been labeled by former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen as a veritable arm of the Pakistani intelligence service. And so you've got insurgents operating there that are not just enjoying sanctuary in neighboring Pakistan, but in some cases getting active materiel support and intelligence support from the neighboring nation. And it poses an enormous threat to the stability of Afghanistan, but an enormous challenge to the overall strategy. This was not supposed to happen this way. For the counterinsurgency strategy to have worked, for the surge to have worked, Pakistan needed to take affirmative steps, and it is not just not done that, but it's working in a far more counterproductive way in Afghanistan.
Let me introduce Ahmed Rashid. He's a journalist based in Lahore, Pakistan. His most recent book is Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan. He joins us today from Madrid. Ahmed Rashid, it's good to have you back on our program, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we have just heard, particularly about the Haqqani Network, not only called an arm of Pakistan intelligence, but also, I believe, labeled now as a terrorist organization by the State Department?
Well, you know, this sanctuary business has been going on now for 11 years, and neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration has really had a strategy to deal with Pakistan. And, of course, Pakistan is now hedging its bets. It sees a potential chaos after 2014. It has a very negative view of what could happen, and it's going to keep the a Taliban, I think, very much in reserve there to become a key player once the Americans leave. I think discussion of the when President Obama came in, he promised a regional strategy by the U.S. In other words, the U.S. would try and broker a deal between all the neighbors of Afghanistan to stop interfering in Afghanistan. That has really broken down since the death of Richard Holbrooke. We're not seeing a really major political initiative to deal with all the neighbors. And Pakistan feels that it's being targeted by the U.S., and the more it is targeted, and of course relations have become very bad in the last year or so, the more, you know, it feels, the military especially feels it is targeted, I think the more it's going to stick to its former policy of maintaining these sanctuaries until 2014.
What sort of policy might the United States adopt that would change the situation enough that Pakistan wouldn't any longer rely on the Taliban, as you say, to be a sort of reserve force in case there's chaos once the American forces leave?
Well, the key issue, I think, here is the need for a political settlement. You know, when we talk about the surge and this transition, what is completely missing from the American NATO lexicon is the need for a political strategy. What are you going to do about the region? What are you going to do about talks with the Taliban? Can you try and bring about a ceasefire between American forces and the Taliban before 2014? And the critics of this transition have been that the whole focus of the military has been on, you know, the military transition. It's not been on the political transition. And that, of course, number one priority there is, you know, talking to the Taliban. There have been talks, but they've been suspended, they've been broken down. There's been a lot of infighting in Washington between the military, the CIA on one side, who are reluctant to go ahead with talks with the Taliban, and others in the State Department and the White House who are more willing. The president has not really put down his foot and said, you know, we want to have these talks. Pakistan is essentially saying that the U.S. should open a proper dilogue with the Taliban, bring in the Karzai government to do the same and discuss power sharing, and Pakistan wants a role in that. Now, that, of course, is very controversial. Will anybody give Pakistan a role for that? But I think if we saw a real major effort in the next administration over the next 18 months for a political dialogue with the Taliban, I think the region would be much more breathing much more easily about the American withdrawal.
Ahmed Rashid, again, a Pakistani journalist. Joseph Collins, Colonel Collins, back to you. You're at the National War College. You've been to Afghanistan recently. What about these disputes between the military and the civilian authorities in Washington, and have they prevented the effort to put together a political settlement region-wide that might help to resolve some of these issues?
No, I don't think that the problems are basically back here, and I don't think that there's a great divide between the civilian and the military. This is a difficult problem. I think the biggest retardant that we've had on the process of making peace has been problems in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. A lot of that has been smoothed over. The Pakistanis are hedging their bets, as Mr. Rashid pointed out, but they also have new incentives to get with the program. Because of the instability in Afghanistan, we now have Pakistani Taliban units operating out of Kunar province and conducting attacks into Pakistan proper. In my conversations with visiting Pakistani military officers, this looms very large in their mind. They're very conscious of the fact that there's not ever going to be a Taliban-style government back in Kabul, and that something other than a Taliban government is going to be the outcome. I couldn't agree more that we need to work towards a solution, a political solution in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. But I'm not sure a comprehensive solution is within our grasp. I think it would be better for us to pursue peace in parts, if you will, and to deal with the disparate parts of the Taliban in conjunction with the Pakistanis, of course, one at a time.
Should we be reluctant to talk to the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Not anymore. Not anymore. We've established the terms. The Afghan Taliban have been very reluctant to talk with the Karzai government. And one of the problems that people had up until this spring was they thought when they said the NATO Expeditionary Force was leaving in December 14th, that meant that we were leaving. We've now signed long-term partnership agreements where we have pledged our assistance out to 2024. We're also talking about creating a new NATO advisory and training force that's going to replace the combat forces that are there right now. So we're not leaving in December of 2014. Our commitment is changing shape, and I think there's a new realization among the upper levels of the government in Pakistan and Afghanistan that is the case.
Let me go back to Ahmed Rashid. How do you respond to what we've just heard?
Well, you know, I mean, he's correct in many ways, but I still believe that I think there are three or four key factors which are absolutely vital that need to be completed before, or need to be halfway completed before the Americans leave. The Americans cannot leave Afghanistan in the present state of civil war. That is a war between the Taliban on one side and U.S. forces and Afghan forces on the other. If you do that, the Afghans are not going to be able to hold up for very long, maybe a year or two. And you could then face a multiple sided civil war with the northern warlords coming in, the government on one side, the Taliban on the other, and that kind of war would drag in all the neighboring countries, Iran, Pakistan, the Central Asian states, Russia, etc. That is a big fear. So what is really needed is a political strategy which deals first primarily with talking to the Taliban and seeing whether some kind of ceasefire will could take place. Secondly, preparing the ground for talks between... The Taliban has said that they're willing to talk to Karzai as a second stage after they have worked out their relationship with the Americans. And obviously, the Taliban need to talk to Karzai if they want some kind of power-sharing deal with him. I don't think the Taliban, they realize fully well that they cannot reconquer the country the way they did. And certainly, you know, the surge has been effective in proving that to them. They can't move north of Kabul because of now the very well-armed militias and other groups who are occupying northern Afghanistan, who are very anti-Taliban. And thirdly, as you know, there's a crisis in Pakistan of huge dimensions, political, economic, terrorism, etc. And Pakistan knows fully well that if it makes any kind of offensive move into Afghanistan, siding with the Taliban, trying to get the Taliban to seize power, etc., all the other neighboring states will reject that and move in also. And that is something Pakistan wants to avoid.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, back to you. In your book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, you come down very hard, as you did in your book on the war in Iraq, about differences between the civilian and military authorities in Washington. How important do you think that is? Colonel Collins downplayed it.
I think it's fundamentally important. We squandered the first year and a half of the surge because of bickering in Washington over the strategy to be taken with regard to potential peace talks and reconciliation with the Taliban. There were fundamental differences of opinion between Richard Holbrook and his team at the State Department and President Obama's national security team at the White House, and it essentially caused sclerosis in the policymaking process, massive infighting, and the net result was that we didn't seize the opportunity when we had maximum leverage on the ground, when troops were coming into the country, as opposed to the present moment when troops are leaving. Let's be clear about this. We are in a moment of declining leverage there. There is no incentive for the Taliban to make a peace deal with us as we are walking out the door. Yes, there will be a follow-on presence of U.S. and potentially NATO forces post-2014, but that number is not yet clear. If there is going to be a deal, big or small, it's likely going to happen after 2014 when the Taliban assess the relative strength of the Afghan security forces, determine and see what our presence there is, and then make a rational calculation whether it makes sense to try to keep on fighting, to seize back larger portions of the country, or to sue for peace. And we also have to look at the American political calendar. You know, these negotiations aren't going to get anywhere, between now and the election, because as one of the potential preconditions is a release of some Guantanamo detainees to a third country in the Middle East. If there's no way that the Obama administration is going to take that step before an election. And so I think the chances of this sort of thing occurring are very slim. And one should also note, getting back to Karzai as a partner here, for reconciliation to work, the Afghan leader needs to balance these competing interests between northern Afghans, who are very fearful of the Taliban getting a greater position in Afghan government and society, and the majority Pashtun population and the Taliban segment of that population, which wants to come back into Afghan society. It requires a deft leader, and thus far, Karzai has not demonstrated an ability to essentially balance those two competing interests as a statesman. And if you don't have that, you're not going to get anywhere.
Okay, Colonel Collins, we have very little time left, but I do want to ask you this. If, in fact, there is a commitment, as you indicated and the others have referred to, beyond 2014, is the American public going to have the political will to see that through? It already appears that people are tired of talking about the war. It hasn't played any role whatsoever in the campaign. We heard today when the president spoke to the UN General Assembly, he only mentioned Afghanistan once and sort of in passing. Are we really going to be able to maintain that commitment past 2014?
I think the commitment is solid. I don't think we should be confused about what's going on in the election here. We have a situation where neither side is going to benefit from talking about the war in Afghanistan, and there's a broad strain of agreement between both camps in the U.S. election as to what's going on there and what we ought to do. We've only made the commitment to Afghanistan out to 2024. We made that commitment in May. I don't think we're going to back away from it very quickly. And it's important also to remember here, and we haven't mentioned it at all today, that the Afghan government in question that's going to be the relevant Afghan government for peacemaking is not the Karzai government. Mr. Karzai has been very clear. He cannot run. He will not run. There will be a new administration. And I agree with what's been said by Rajiv in particular, that this is not likely to be settled between now and January. This is likely job one for the next presidential.
Okay. All right. And that obviously leaves the question open, too, as to whether there will be sufficient stability in Afghanistan in 2014 for elections to occur, not just for the president, but for the parliament as well. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Colonel Joseph Collins, he retired formerly with the Deputy's Assistant Secretary of Defense, now at the National War College. Rajiv Chandrasekaran at The Washington Post, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Ahmed Rashid, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and our earlier guest, Rod Nordland of The New York Times from Kabul. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. American universities claim to be fighting gender discrimination, but bias against women is alive and well, even in science. We'll hear how professors assess male and female students with the same credentials. That in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Yale University has released a study demonstrating that science professors are biased against women. And that's even true of female professors. Jo Handelsman is the study's senior author. She is a Yale professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology. Professor Handelsman, good to have you on our program.
Well, thanks for having me, Warren.
Where did you conduct this study? What was the method?
The method was a randomized controlled trial in which the only variable was student gender, and I think that's the power of it, that everything else was identical. We sent a description of a student's record to faculty in biology, chemistry, and physics departments at six research universities across the U.S., and each participant received an identical description, the only difference being that we randomly assigned either a male or a female name to each one. And then we asked them a series of questions about the student, and that revealed that they would be more likely to hire the man. They would be more likely to provide him mentoring than the female student. And they thought that he was more competent, and that seemed to be the reason why they would be more likely to hire, and they would offer him a higher salary. And these are with the identical record, simply John or Jennifer being at the top of the page.
How many professors did you talk to, and what sorts of percentages did you get?
We sent out, we had about one-third of the faculty responded, and so we had about 127 responses. And that was significant because the demographics of that group was identical to the demographics of both the faculty, all of the faculty we sent it to, but also the faculty in the larger pool of research universities in the U.S. So the distribution was the same in terms of gender, race, age, that kind of thing. And so it was a pretty significant group to have 125 of them.
And you said there were 125 responses?
Yep.
And by what proportion did they prefer the men to the women?
Well, on a 7-point scale where they expressed their ratings, the preference was between 0.5, so half a point and 1 point for all of the parameters. And for the salary, it was an average of $30,000 for the man and about $26,000 for the woman. So these were, 1 point on a 7-point scale is pretty substantial. And it also pushed the man just over the 50% mark, that about more than half of the faculty would hire him. And the woman was under the 50% mark, which said that she had less than 50% likelihood of being hired.
And female faculty went along the same lines?
Absolutely. We found no effect of any aspect of the faculty who were making the judgments. And so whether it was a man or woman or independent of race or whether they were in biology, chemistry, or physics, we got the same result.
You talked with some of these scientists afterward, and I take it that they thought they were very objective people. How did they respond to the results?
We actually haven't spoken to them. So
I'm sorry. I thought you did.
We don't know. Only a couple of them contacted us, and we've had conversations with them, but it was before the publication. So we're very interested now to see if we get responses from those who participated.
In the abstract, your study says that interventions addressing gender bias might advance the goal of increasing the participation of women in science. What do you mean by intervention?
Well, the focus for a lot of universities that want to increase the diversity of their faculty have been on the practical things that act as impediments to women's careers. So the tenure structure and childcare accessibility. And those are incredibly important, but they're not enough if we're going to really solve the problem. And so we're thinking of, by interventions in this case, first of all, sharing the data with faculty so that scientists understand that they're not excluded from this bias. They're just like everybody else and seem to have the same biases and apply them to judgments about people. And then next, to ask them to begin to evaluate their own decision-making and hold themselves and other people accountable. To me, it would be a real ideal if we could just ask each other without making people defensive or angry, are we holding everybody to the same standard here, or did we evaluate that paper or grant or whatever the item might be the way we would have if it was a person of the other gender? Right now, I find most people get very defensive about that because they think you're pointing a finger or accusing. But if we accept that everyone, men and women, older, younger, in all the disciplines of science, carry these biases, then it becomes something to simply protect the process of selecting people and their work. It just assures that we're doing it on merit and not on these unconscious assumptions.
Maybe you should take the names off of the applications. Have you yourself felt a gender bias?
I think probably every minority group has felt a gender bias, and I should say that when men act in certain ways that are inconsistent with our mental images of men, they also feel gender bias. They're just not the same biases that are against women. So I think our mental prejudices affect how we evaluate everyone, and I think it's impossible to avoid that.
And very quickly, six research universities were involved in this. Can you name them?
No, I can't. Our human subjects approval depends on keeping the universities anonymous. I can say that they were across the U.S., so geographically distributed, and there were three private and three public, and they were all very, very high quality.
Okay, we can identify your university, Yale University, where you conducted this study. Again, Joe Handelsman is a professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks so much for covering the story.
Today's program produced by Evan George, Sonia Geis, and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.